Limit. This isn't the unit of I don't know, Benson. What's his name? Benton. Sorry.
Benson. Yeah. George Benson.
This isn't the unit of Benson. Oh, fuck.
Of Benson and Hedges.
This isn't the unit of Benton making cocoa on the Doctor's Bunsen burner. This is, or them watching, I don't
it's
know,
funny cause you took
BBC
three,
3.
It's funny because you took 3 takes to do that joke, and it's Mike Yates that makes the cocoa on them.
That's it, okay. All right, okay. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to episode 36 of On the Time Lash podcast. Hello, I'm Ben. That was really, I really went for it there.
That was like, what up, YouTube?
Hey guys, it's Ben, it's Benny V here, and Doctor Who was wicked last night, huh?
It was a bit like that.
Yeah.
It was a bit like that.
That was
no
so...
disrespect to our YouTube brethren in the Doctor Who community. Hello, I'm Mark, by the way. Yes. I should probably point that out.
Mark, voice of sanity, Donaldson.
God.
Boy, Mark, let's just bring it in there, yeah, Donaldson. <That's>...
bring it down a notch. We grew up when it wasn't on the telly. We didn't grow up when it was on the telly.
Yeah.
We're not allowed to be excitable. And
yeah, as an old school fan, don't you just get irritated by the positivity of new fans who don't ever think that this will be snatched away from them again?
Yeah.
I mean, how often do you sit down for a new series and go, well, this is the last one. This is it. This is done. It's going to be cancelled next week, isn't it?
I know.
10 years on every episode.
Yeah.
I think that's the last one.
At the start of every year, it's like, when you leave in, when you... Whereas these fucking youngsters, with their positivity and their enjoyment of this series, how dare they?
It's going to go on forever. It's going to go on forever for these people, isn't it? Isn't it? Anyway, episode 36, Sontaran Stratagem, The Poison Sky, and we've paired it up with The Invasion. I mean, episode numbers, nobody gives a shit. What you're listening for, listeners, is what we're going to be talking about in this episode. I don't know, but firstly, Fortnite and Doctor Who.
Mm-hmm.
Now, because we're doing the little Doctor Who extra episodes, we're kind of up to date with news now, where like this time last year we were woefully behind.
We were way behind.
The big thing that's happened to me is that I moved to London. I live in London now. And I live in Ealing. And one of the first places, I mentioned this in passing in other kind of other podcasts. The first thing I did was toddle on down Ealing Broadway and check out where the carnage from Spearhead from Space took place. Loved it.
Mm-hmm.
What I discovered the other day, though, I didn't know this, because it's a great resource, is the website DoctorWhoLocations.com.net, something like that. What I discovered, I didn't know this. I think I was going to set myself little kind of Doctor Who trips around London.
I think I know where this is, and I think this is the text message that... Anyway, we'll cover that in a bit.
Yeah, I was going to set myself... So I'd looked into Spearhead from Space, and I'd checked out kind of Ealing Broadway and Ealing Studios. Also, the Ealing Broadway trains, the actual subway station underground. Above it is a great big tower block that was BBC Villiers House.
Oh, right.
Which they shot some stuff for Enemy of the World on top of.
Okay.
Which is nice.
Sadly, you couldn't get on top, I imagine. There wasn't some sort of...
Not allowed to do that. Can't. But every time I stand on the platform and look up, it's... I mean, that's what I mean. Like, it's you get little thrills living in this new area. And I thought Ealing Broadway, which is maybe a 15-minute walk from my house, is as close to a Doctor Who location. 4 minutes from my house, thanks to Doctor Who Locations' website, did I discover is the Avenue, the West Ealing Avenue, and it is where the Drayton Court pub, the Ace in Survival, goes looking for some friends within. And I don't know if it's the actual shop, but it's certainly the frontage of the shop that Hale and Pace operate in Survival.
Well, if we do Survival anytime soon, I think we'll be doing a... is it still a pub?
So yeah, is it still a pub? It's my
there
local.
There we are.
Well, so when I was waiting for internet to get connected, I had to go and use the Wi-Fi there every day. So I was already going into this place every day. I really like it. It's a really nice pub.
Yeah.
Before I worked out, not only is it my local, but is it the Doctor Who, a Doctor Who pub.
Do you still have a picnic table outside?
They don't, and I don't think they ever did, because they've got a truly colossal beer garden at the back.
Right.
So I don't know why they would ever need to be out front on a very narrow pavement. So I think it was just there as a place for Sophie Aldred to sit.
They probably just pulled one out from the back.
Stuck
it in the front.
While Sylvester McCoy comes out of a shop holding many cans of of cat food. But you know, the thrill that you get from that is, firstly, you live really near a Doctor Who location.
Yeah.
Secondly, in terms of survival, all the streets, Perivale, West Ealing, they all look exactly as they do. Like they all have that same look of particular type of London house you get in survival. More than that, there are black cats everywhere. Fucking everywhere. So, and seriously, they just appear. It's not like you see them walking down the street. It's like you'll walk by a car and there'll be a little cat sitting there going at you. And it's great. It's like living in survival. It's living in an episode of the survival.
Fantastic.
So I don't know. We've talked about this many times before. The thrill that you get from going to Doctor Who locations.
Yeah.
And the more public ones, you know, like the centre of London, all that kind of stuff. They're tourist attractions in their own right. But very specifically Doctor Who locations, you get a little thrill seeing them. I know it's weird. I know it's warped. But I get a thrill every time I walk past the department store from Spearhead from Space where the policeman is brutally gunned down.
But it's all acting, isn't it? It's okay. You're not actually taking thrill in the fact that a man was murdered there. You're taking thrill in the fact there was a location of a television.
When you're walking down the street and there's a bus stop there is a bus stop there now, as there was in 1969, 1970, in Ealing Broadway, and you're walking down the street and you see people waiting for a bus and you imagine them being gunned down and dying with smoke billowing out of their backs.
Well, that's maybe something you want to speak to your counsellor about.
We're under the Sontaran stratagem and the poison sky.
We've already done the drinks. I was going to go, what's your poison, Ben? But you've already told him it was a cup of tea, so...
Sontaran stratagem went out on the 26th of April, 2008, 6:20 till 7:05. So did the poison sky, which went out on the 3rd of May, 2008.
Fucking hell, Doctor Who airing at the same time 2 weeks in a row.
Yeah.
Fancy that.
Ridiculous. And at the start of an evening, rather than
once everybody's fucked off to the pub.
I can't believe that in all the chat about ratings, nobody has come up with the idea that ratings are lower because it's now at exactly the point that if you go out on a Sunday, you're out. Sorry, on a Saturday, you're out on a Saturday. Yeah. Right, when Doctor Who was on at 6 o'clock, you could start your evening, and then you could go out.
Well, that's what I used to do. I'd have a couple of cans, watch Doctor Who. Right, that's that finished. Off I go.
Yeah.
Can't do that now.
So where are we? Sorry. Sometimes Stratagem had 7.1 million viewers. Poison Sky had 6.5 million viewers, presumably because those who dropped off had seen the Sontarans when they saw part one.
Rain or out.
Yeah. Get ready, guys. This is going to be one of these drunken, sweaty, it's not very good ones. I say drunken.
Which you love.
You love. You fucking love
you
it.
You fucking love it.
As always, where, Mr. Markington, do you think...
Well, do you know what, right?
First 5 decades poll.
Until the other day when I actually watched this again.
Yeah.
In my head, I was like, no, it's all right, that one. I seem to remember that being quite good.
Yeah.
I quite look forward to it.
Yeah. However, episode is going to be about memory cheating.
I'm afraid. Oh, God. The whole episode.
Yeah.
I think we're going to upset some of our...
Just you wait until...
I think we're going to upset some of our core listeners, I think, if that's the case.
Yeah. All of you are just fast-forwarding into the invasion bit now, aren't you?
Yeah.
Don't know why I'm saying this now, because none of you are listening to it, because you've all fast-forwarded, haven't you?
What do you think of the invasion? I don't know.
But
I still don't think it, even if people are thinking it's good. And I did see a comment the other week saying that it would need to be, every episode of this current series would need to be the Sontaran stratagem for it not to be the best series of Doctor Who that we've had. So maybe it's not that held that highly in esteem. What about 182?
182.
Maybe that's a bit harsh.
It is, not by much though. Sometimes Stratagem Poison Sky is 144.
Okay.
Down from 91. It's between Full Circle and the Mythmakers. So kind of.
Yeah, kind of middle of the road.
Slappity bang.
Company middle. There, isn't it?
Yeah. Fair, is it? I think maybe. Right, now, okay, well, we'll start with you. Because a lot of our Twitter fans seem to enjoy the when you sit down to watch an episode, your little commentary on Twitter. And you.
Well, indeed, yeah. One of our followers, Parky Tab, he remembers enjoying it very much and said that seeing my tweets about it, he was like, I'm really looking forward to hearing this episode. Because apparently we've changed his mind on a number of different stories.
Yeah. He used to love Doctor Who, but it's all shit now.
He hates it because of us. the thing is, I've watched it quite a bit, and every time I watch it, I clearly don't enjoy it, but then I don't hate it enough that it sticks in my memory as, you know, oh, warning, there's some Taran stratagems coming up, you're not going to like it. I stick it on. And do you know what I think it is? I think Chris Ryan is so good.
Okay.
That I kind of just go, oh yeah, the Centaurans were really good in that, weren't they?
Yeah.
No, they weren't.
No, they're not. That's my problem with it as well. That is my problem. I think everything else, the architecture, the furniture, I think the acting, I think the main problem is that you've got this Centauran-shaped hole where the threat should be.
Yeah.
Because they're small. They don't look like Centaurans.
No.
Which are supposed to be not small but stocky. But what we have essentially it looks like a lot of kids running around.
Yeah.
It looks like a lot of kids, very slight little gazelle type of baddies.
I think what we'll probably be doing with this is we may be doing quite a lot of comparisons, which is not normal for us, but we may be doing quite a few comparisons to a future story.
Yeah.
Being the Zygon invasion. Because they are actually both very similar in terms of an evil clone of a companion. What they've done with the Zygons.
Yeah, they're faithful.
Yeah, they're faithful to the original incarnation. And they're really, and they're good, they're scary. You know, they're probably threatening in that story. Whereas the Centaurans, I think the mask is quite good until you get to the massive ears, which were never a thing, and the kind of weird plasticky kind of armour.
Yeah.
Kind of this kind of blue plastic.
Well, it looks more like a play suit.
Yeah.
Rather than a warrior's.
Exactly. And then also, this whole thing about the glory of battle and the kind of glory of dying in battle and an honourable death. So, why is it? It's explained as to why they don't do it to the two soldiers, because they need them hypnotically control them to get Martha and blah, yada, 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 right? Mm-hmm. So, fine, I can buy into that, why they jam their guns.
Yeah.
But then why are they doing it for the rest of the story?
Yeah.
And the Doctor keeps going, oh, that's not very... Why are you doing that? We won't bother explaining that, don't worry. But I will... The problem this story has is that the Doctor keeps flagging up all the problems with it. There's the bit at the start of The Poison Sky where they're doing the chant and he changes the channel.
Yeah.
And you kind of go, I wish I could do that as well.
Yeah. Two fact fans, an episode of Tommy Zoom. There's another thing that nobody knows what the fuck it is, but it will be forever preserved within Doctor Who.
I wonder if the Master's a fan of Tommy Zoom.
Nobody's a fan of Tommy Zoom. Not even the Doctor.
I don't even know what Tommy Zoom is.
Not even the Doctor. He doesn't want to speak to the Centaurans again. He just wants Tommy Zoom off the screen. I know exactly what you mean. Okay, so obviously their plan is a little different. It's not a straight up and up invasion.
No.
It's got to be to a degree covert because it's not something that they want to dominate. They want it as a breeding planet.
Yeah.
But you are right. When it comes to them in battle, it is not battle.
No, it's trickery.
It is sport.
Yeah.
It is butchery. So it seems very cowardly. It seems very... It just at no point do you get a sense of them. Because all the chat... is very Klingon, or Jem'Hadar from Star Trek Deep Space Nine. It's all of that. It's all about honour and faith and glory and dying in battle and war as a way of life. But you never ever see them do anything except shoot guns at people who can't fight back.
Yeah.
You never see them, I don't know, dispatch with a gun and run into battle wielding a knife or a sword or something for hand-to-hand combat. Probably because the suit that they wear is so moulded to the actors' bodies, it is impossible to move in, according to interviews and background reading and stuff. So what you have are, you're told one thing, and then you see something completely different. You see them not being particularly an effective baddie at all. And again, yeah, and as you say, you have the Doctor going, what are you up to? What is this? Yeah. Is this shit? Well, come on, viewers. You can see this as well, can't you?
And also, in terms of the logic of the thing, the invasion, which obviously we're going to come to later on, Tobias Vaughn has had this plan in place for 5 years, and you believe that because you've not really had the Doctor from contemporary Earth that much.
Yeah.
Over the Second Doctor's era.
Yeah.
So you can go, well, fine, he's dropped him because it's 4 years after the Web of Fear or whatever. Yeah. Fine, I can believe that, that this businessman's been putting all this plan together, etc., etc. Yeah. The Doctor's never fucking off contemporary Earth.
Yeah.
And you kind of feel as if this Atmos thing would maybe have been mentioned to him passing.
Fine,
there's bumper stickers and things like that. Fine.
Yeah.
But unless you're somebody like us,
yeah,
going, oh, what does that mean? Oh, what does this mean? Nothing has changed in any way. And that's quite a big thing, something that like completely reduces carbon emissions. You think that would be, like, that's
it
the future.
It must be only a matter of days between Partners in Crime and
the film.
Because when Donna shows up again, I mean, obviously, you know, like Wilf and her mum are glad to see her, but they're not, where the fuck have you been?
It's just like, oh, where have you been? Well, I stayed over at so-and-so's house.
This isn't 6 months. How long was it?
18 months or something like that, isn't it?
It was 12 months.
Yeah.
12 hours, 12 months.
Yeah.
Yeah, this isn't Rose disappearing for a whole year.
Yeah.
It must be just a matter of days.
Yeah.
So, but then maybe everyone has been so looking at Adipose Industries.
Well, maybe, and Unit have been invested. Whatever, fine. But it never feels as if this plan has been this big global scheme.
Yeah.
And I think also because, what's his fucking name, Luke Rattigan?
Yeah.
Is so awful. And it's like that whole Rattigan Academy storyline. And I don't mean this as any disrespect to Sarah Jane Adventures, because I love the Sarah Jane Adventures.
Yeah.
And actually, although I say that's a storyline I could see in the Sarah Jane Adventures, they would probably have done it a lot better. But it doesn't feel like... It feels like it's in a different show, that whole plot.
There's a... Not even the plot. I know what you mean. You said this before recording. I don't know. Do you want to say this looks like Doctor Who, CBBC Doctor Who?
Yeah, yeah. There is a distinct CBBC feel to things.
And it's not just... It's not just the various elements of the plot. It's the colour scheme.
Mm-hmm.
Everything is colourful.
Yeah.
Look at the cloning chamber. It's all purples and greens and lights and atmospheric shots.
Yeah.
You know, like, we all know what Sontaran looks like, but no, they show up in a blue plastic romper suit in this thing.
Yeah.
They're looking all colourful. You know, even down to the fact that it's a really staggeringly red beret that the unit the unit troops wear. Everything is just so colourful in a way that I think is kind of dating.
Yes.
And it does look like it's screaming kids show at you and trying to soften any fear or adult theme or content or violence or anything like that in a way that, as you say, comparing it to the episode that's just been on, the Saigon invasion.
Yeah. That is not a CBBC show.
Yeah, just Rebecca Front screaming at somebody in an earpiece to shoot somebody that looks like his ma coming out of church.
And it has these kind of washed out colours.
And it's obviously shot in summer, but they want to make it look like a show.
Kind of thing.
Yeah.
Whereas this is like, it's kind of headache inducing at some points. It's so colourful. Like, the Doctor's not even wearing his brown suit, he's wearing his blue, colourful suit with his red tie.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't understand what's happening. It doesn't feel... Because as we've talked about in this...
The Rattigan Academy pupils have got
all these
red...
orange jumpsuit, sort of hoodies and tracksuit bottoms and stuff. But we talked about with, like, Fires of Pompeii and with Planet of the Ood, that, like, these things feel like we're moving ahead and we're doing, like, new and interesting things with... And these locations are feeling properly like what they're supposed to be, an alien planet or, like, you know, ancient Pompeii.
Yeah.
And this seems to be kind of, again, no disrespect, but dragging it right back to these kind of, the early days of, like, Keith Boak doing Rose and Aliens of London and World War III. that kind of thing where it doesn't know whether or not it wants to be a kid's show or a family show or a sci-fi drama.
Sure.
It's kind of gone back to that. And you're like, but we've had a pretty good run of things. We know what we're doing. Why is this... It's really odd. It's
interesting that you bring up Aliens of London there. The conclusion to this story is a bit... I don't want to say it is a bit Aliens of London, but essentially the conclusion to this story is that they burn off a massive fart. There's a noxious gas which is covering the planet.
Yeah.
So what does the Doctor do? Strikes a massive match and burns it off to get rid of the gas and the smell. That's how this story ends.
I think a giant arse hanging over the Earth would have probably had more gravitas than these reimagined Sontarans.
So this is the fifth appearance of the Sontarans. We've got four classic adventures, and this is the first of them coming back. One of the problems I have is not necessarily that they're portrayed as not much of a threat. So the thinking behind it, of them being fairly small, is because that was the original intention of Robert Holmes.
Yeah.
That were going to be these kind of wee kind of clone type of things, and you know you would go, oh, they're obviously not a threat.
And Kevin Lindsay was never. Yes, he's shorter
exactly,
than John Pertwee.
Yeah. So there's a difference between small and stocky, and that's what Kevin Lindsay was, and he was also padded up.
Yeah.
So that, because the thing is, the Sontarans are small, but they're also thin in this adventure.
Yeah.
Whereas the other Sontarans may have been a little smaller than the leading man, which is not very small at all, because both Pertwee and Tom Baker, are towering. Actors,
yeah,
you know, like if you look at I don't know, so these Sontarans stratagems, they're smaller than Martha, but in the original series, like they were still towering over like Sarah Jane, and they're about the same size as Harry Sullivan.
Yeah.
You know, it's so
no, exactly.
So there's that kind of weird thing that this idea that Sontarans are supposed to be small. Well, that was never shown in the classic series, and what you have is Christopher Ryan's got a great voice, but both him and Dan Starkey play the Sontarans as typical military figures from 1960s sketch comedy. You know, kind of, Perkins, come in, sit down. We need you to pop over to France and do a bit of reconnaissance and, you know, like that kind of famous...
More of which later.
Yeah, well, yeah. So they've got that kind of thing of going, yes, sir, it'd be good to get into the front and taste some blood now, ha, 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 you know. Whereas all the other Sontarans were very kind of, they were very toad-like, they were very disgusting. To Kevin Lindsay constantly licking his lips and going, iron ground. There was something really disgusting about it, which really helped the character differentiate the Sontarans from emotionless Cybermen or staccato Daleks, which I suppose was a great strength of monster making in the 60s and 70s. Whereas if you don't have an awful lot of money in order to create a believable character, voice was a very key ingredient. But what we have is a complete removal of that kind of like disgusting aspect. So they're almost cutesy in this episode, in this story.
In a way.
Too cutesy, too standard, you know, too standard kind of cliche,
I mean,
military buffoon.
A lot of people point to Stephen Moffat and Strax as kind of, you know.
Do you know who Strax reminds me of?
Who?
Hugh Laurie in Blackadder Goes Forth.
Yeah. But a lot of people have kind of pointed to Stephen Moffat and said, you know, oh, he's made a joke of this sometimes with Strax, but Strax is a perfectly natural progression from what we have in the Sontarans stratagem with the Poison Sky.
Yeah.
It's nothing to do with Moffat's writing.
Strax.
That is the Sontarans that we have in the new series.
Yeah.
And actually I quite like Strax as a character.
Yeah.
Because the whole point of Strax is that he's an oddity.
Yeah.
To the Sontarans that we know. So that kind of actually works. Whereas when actually you're presented, when you go back and watch this story, you're like, well, no, he's just like exactly like these ones here.
Yeah.
They're not that warlike. They're not like, they are quite.
They're a joke. What they seem
like,
Or at least they're you know, like it's all bravado. They don't, you know, because I mean, another thing you do have to ask yourself. Sorry, the first thing I want to say was that at least now Dan Starkey as Strax is more like a classic Sontar because he does it. He gives out a lot of the kind of the teeth and lip licking.
Yeah, and also
and they're gonna
He's actually also quite good in the Big Finish audios, but that's another thing. But also actually when he's in that kind of butler costume, he looks a lot kind of broader than he does in that kind of blue armour. So actually, you kind of like the scene in The Name of the Doctor where he's fighting the big Glaswegian fella.
Yeah,
like that works.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's to do with the armour. I think the armour is the main problem.
Yeah.
With how they're presented.
That is the main problem for me, because let's move on to the more positive things, because there certainly are a lot of positive things.
Well, there's still
things,
a lot of negative things, but okay.
Okay, sure. Well, all right then. I mean, let's not beat about the bush. That's what the cunts want to listen to, so... That's what everyone wants to listen to, so let's have that.
I love Free Management, right?
Yeah.
I really like Free Management. I think Martha Jones is a great character in Series 3. Do you know what Jenna Coleman does at the end of the Zygon Invasion, where she just fucking flips on a coin and you're like... Brilliant.
She's really evil.
That's brilliant.
Yeah.
Oh, I mean, obviously we know that Martha's been cloned. And actually, to be honest with you, I don't really understand why. Because there's the whole thing, they go, oh, well, we hypnotically controlled these two soldiers, but for you, we need to clone you for some such reason.
Yeah.
So that she can just press a button on a mobile app that controls the nuclear weapons of the world.
Well, yes, okay. I mean, I don't really want to go into it, but... This whole thing is so convoluted as to fall apart the moment you start looking at it. Yeah. I think, our regular social media pal, the Polis Box, at the Polis Box, was dead on. It was going, so what are the Suntarans doing? Just going, are they basically giant Lord Sugars? They're going door to door.
They're just,
selling Atmos.
It's an apprentice task.
Yeah. Like, the essential start point of this story has been, sat-navs and, like the workings of a car.
Yeah.
That sounds like you could do some kind of, urban Doctor Who monster threat, mm-hmm. a la Terror of the Autons. Like, okay, so let's just re-engineer this backwards, but without asking any pertinent questions. Who's controlling it? Sontarans are due to come back, are they not? Yeah, okay, at least the Sontarans are doing it. Without really joining up any dots. Yeah. It is so convoluted. So yeah, why does Martha have to be cloned?
Why is she not just like under hypnosis?
Yeah, which is, it's not just the two shoulders, it's soldiers, it's everybody in that factory.
All it needs is just one line of dialogue that, I don't know, because...
Wait, sorry, remind me first. Is the answer... Okay, do they clone Martha before they know the Doctor's involved, or is it after? Does the cloning come as a result that they know the Doctor's involved?
I think they know the Doctor's involved by that point, yeah.
So they probably clone her.
Because...
In order to... Maybe. But again...
But how do they know she's the Doctor's coming? Because they've only met the Doctor in the Rattigan Academy.
No, but again... Why do they need to clone her? Why can't they just mind control her?
Like, all it needs is one line of dialogue, like in The Sea Devils.
Yeah.
Where he goes, oh, well, all our soldiers have been trained to resist hypnotic control.
Yeah.
Fine, there you go, sorted.
Yeah, done.
Right, clone her, there we go. Seconds of dialogue. It's just, none of it just makes sense.
Yeah.
And, like, the whole thing about, like, NATO's nuclear weapons are controlled by an app.
Yeah, on your phone.
On that you can just like remotely access on your phone.
She didn't. She put on a little SD card.
Aye, fine, but
well, what if she was running and in her pocket, I don't know, some keys.
Oh God!
Hit the screen.
We won't pocket dial somebody when we're not meant to.
It doesn't have a little flap. Doesn't have a little screen protector flap. It's what if it just hits yes? Oh shit! Oh, my key gonk hit the pad. Sorry, mate.
End of the world.
it's
ridiculous.
Oh no!
It's utterly, utterly ridiculous.
My arse just killed everything. Oh no! Which I suppose nicely plays into the kind of whole light a fart solution. Yeah.
Okay, well, the reason we paired this up with the invasion was UNIT, okay?
Yeah, yes, okay.
So let's talk about UNIT.
Okay. I don't recognise it as familiar UNIT.
I never have with Russell T's UNIT.
Yeah.
It's this kind of post-9/11, what would UNIT be like in a post-9/11 society?
Yeah.
Don't care, mate. They're just really... They're always presenting... I remember there's a Torchwood episode, I think quite near the end of Series 1, where that kind of does everybody's backstory and how they came to work for Torchwood.
Yeah.
And Tosh gets like basically like locked in like a Guantanamo Bay style situation.
Yeah, I remember that, yeah.
And you're just like, this isn't the unit that I recognise.
Yeah. This isn't the unit of Mike Yates using the Doctor's Bunsen burner to make some cocoa. What do we have? So what was UNIT really when we were familiar with it? So you do all this, you call it the UNIT family. But it was essentially a group of characters as opposed to an organisation. Mm-hmm. You very rarely ever saw anyone that wasn't the Brigadier, Captain Yates, or Benton.
Unless they were all getting murdered.
Yes, unless you needed somebody to be murdered, then there was just kind of, you know, unless the jail guards start showing up at your top secret country pile and start shooting you down. There's only like three or four of you. Yeah. They looked like what essentially Torchwood was, which was a very small, very badly funded organisation that would sequester army elements if it needed to. Now it seems like a colossal thing, and it seems to have lost any understanding or heart or creativity in the situation. Colonel Mace, played by Rupert Holiday Evans,
who was recently the juror that Phil Mitchell tried to bribe to get Max Browning off in EastEnders.
He is a familiar face without you really knowing who he is.
It took four episodes of EastEnders of him kind of just mugging at the camera during the trial for me to go, that's the guy from the Downs
Captain. What you have in him is someone who obviously is very human, but he seems as blinkered as any standard military figure.
Yes.
Which, as much as people bring up the kind of, you know, the conclusion to Doctor Who and the Silurians, the Brigadier...
Yeah.
You know, he bombed that group of Silurians out of existence.
But that's not a decision the Brigadier takes lightly.
No, he doesn't take it lightly. You know, and he never has moments following that where he is so resolutely bloodthirsty and military. Mm-hmm. Whereas everyone who's in this just seems like they're, let's do it, let's bomb some stuff, let's set a light, what's going on.
And that's why I kind of identify the unit, the sort of Kate Stewart unit, more with the kind of, because it is a bit more homespun.
Yeah.
It's people in literally a house in the Zircon Invasion or the Tower of London, you know, before that. But I think a better script could have maybe done something with that, that this isn't the unit that you know from the 70s. Yeah. You know, there's just one line of dialogue where it goes, oh, well, I think I preferred it when it was a bit more homespun.
Yeah.
Right, fine. That means nothing to the viewer. It means literally nothing to the fans either.
Yeah.
It's just like...
It's just generic military.
Yeah, it's just like, all right, so you're bigger now unit. And you've got less of a personality. Yeah. All right.
But I don't think that Rupert Holiday Evans has the gravitas as an actor, that's not what I mean. He, in his performance, he doesn't portray as endearingly a character as Angela Bruce did with Brigadier Bambera in Battlefield.
No, that's quite a good comparison, actually.
So you know, the brig is obviously in that, but you do get a sense that Bambera, as a taken over as the head of unit, or someone who's high up in unit at any rate, has the same. You know, has the same good humour and personality.
Absolutely.
And creativity and thought as the brig did.
The whole point at the end of Battlefield is that there is that suggestion that if Doctor Who was to come back, was to continue, I mean, obviously they thought they were going to continue, but like, look at it with hindsight, that, you know, Angela Bruce would have been back and that would have been the new unit.
Yeah.
And you may have had Nick Courtney in the background helping wherever possible.
Yeah.
And I mean, I know Big Finish have done some audios adapted from those storylines that were mooted, and I think one of them was going to be a unit story with Angela Bruce.
Yeah.
And that's fine. You go, well, I recognise that unit. Although they're a bit gruffer, a bit, you know.
Yeah.
She actually, you know, there's a heart to her. There's that glint in the eye that you have with Nick Courtney.
Yeah.
There's a sense of humour. Whereas this is this kind of macho, like the two soldiers that go and find the cloning pods. It's like, cool, blimey. Ooh, lads. Ooh, we found the cloning pods.
Yeah. Well, very, what you could consider as very un-unit, sort of personality. But if we find this, we'll get promotion.
Yeah.
As in, what are you, Ferengi from Star Trek, where the only reason you're doing your job is personal acquisition? Is that what?
Is that why you joined the military?
Yeah. I mean, the guy who plays Ross
is great.
Really like him. It's a shame he dies, because I think the main problem is that nobody really gives a shit about UNIT as a thing. It's you care about it, or you are happy to see it because of the its embodiment within a particular character. Yeah. So that's why it's great seeing Kate Ledford Stewart back, and that's why everyone was going, oh, for fuck, come on, that was good.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Because everyone liked those characters, mm-hmm. and therefore liked what they perceive the organisation to be through them.
Because
whereas you feel nothing for this
you don't.
Thing. This, it's not the same thing, because the characters are not there for you to like. No. Ross, yes, but, you know, what is he? He's a driver, and that's it.
Yeah, it's
He's great in those scenes when they're at Rattigan Academy, mm-hmm. and he's essentially a companion with the Doctor, and the Doctor obviously likes him.
Yeah.
You know, it would have been nice if he stayed alive, and then maybe he, I don't know,
pops up again.
Yeah. Like, when I do start liking UNIT again, is Planet of the Dead. I wish Malcolm would come back. I would love Lee Evans to have a semi-regular appearance.
Well, he gets a name second day of the Doctor, so he's clearly still there.
He is, but come on, I mean, he's retired from comedy now, some would say, thank Christ. So why could we not have him back as,
Who knows? No, yeah. But I agree with you. I think that it's the fact that what we relate UNIT with is that family feel.
Yeah.
That kind of, you know, the Doctor's friends.
Imagine setting up UNIT in the invasion and them not having brought Nicholas Courtney back.
Mm-hmm. That's essentially what they're doing.
Yeah. But that story, I think, would be radically, very differently mm-hmm. thought of.
Yeah, probably.
Because you don't have a trusted familiar face there.
Possibly. It's a great shame. It is just a really, really, really great shame that Nick Courtney was never in the series. And I think that it's not felt so much, I think, in something like The Power of Three, but it's felt here because you need somebody likable.
Yeah.
The reason you don't necessarily feel it in Power of Three is because Gemma Redgrave as Kate Stewart is great,
mm-hmm.
and you know she has that great rapport with the Doctor, and you're like, oh, okay, fine, this is our new UNIT, this is somebody we can relate to, whereas with this you've got like a fairly ineffectual colonel,
you've got an any character,
yeah, you've got any military character, and the fact the Doctor just spends so much time slagging him off as well,
yeah,
you're just like, well, stand up for yourself for fuck's sake.
Yeah,
the Brigadier wouldn't take this.
Yeah, I mean,
and Tennant comes off really badly in most of this as well, because there's a point at which I just go and just fuck it, we get it, you don't like guns, go and just take it down a notch.
Well, it
and
reminds again, me of the caretaker in series 8,
yeah,
and the Doctor don't like a soldier,
yeah,
deliberately berating soldiers. Now I get it, because he presumably all of this I hate soldiers kind of malarkey comes from the fact that during the Time War he was a soldier.
Yes.
That he essentially, by directing hatred towards soldiers, is directing hatred against
himself,
that period of his life. We get it, but it's not appealing.
No,
like it's not. There's, you know, because as much as we're saying that they're fairly ineffectual, they're not unlikable or evil characters.
No,
you know, we're not screaming at the screen, "You idiot! Don't do that! Don't!" You know,
they're making fairly UNIT style decisions.
Yeah,
like, oh, well, we should bomb them, or
because I mean, it's not uncommon for the Doctor to be rude to UNIT.
No,
you know, Pertwee was always grumpy. Baker was a bit grumpy when he met them, but they were never as abrasive as Tennant seemed deliberately needling.
Yeah, exactly. That's it. It's deliberately needling, because when Pertwee and Baker do it, it's because they're like frustrated with like the red tape or you know, just the formalities of military service, or like, you know, the quickness to kind of go, well, we should shoot at it. No, we shouldn't. We should just maybe. But Tennant just walks in and just starts slagging folk off.
Yeah.
And people, and I was all the way through watching it, and people called the 12th Doctor abrasive and rude and unlikable in his first series. Genuinely, I don't see any difference between how Tennant relates to most of the UNIT staff with anything Capaldi does in Series 8.
Yeah.
I don't see any difference in it.
Mm-hmm.
And because David Tennant's got his lovely hair.
He looks so pretty.
And, you know, his eyes. And his blue, his tightly fitted suit.
Yeah.
Gets away with murder. No more.
Okay, alright, okay. This has been a considerable time spent on what we didn't like about this. But I don't hate this story. There's a lot to understand.
Nobody hates any Doctor Who story. There's Doctor Who stories we don't like.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody hates.
No, but, you know, I think what we sound like.
truth
is that there is no enjoyment or joy or goodness to be got out of this.
There totally is.
Yeah.
There is really positive things, and I think those positive things are Bernard Cribbins and Catherine Tate.
Yes, yeah. I mean, I like Martha when she's not a clone. It's nice to see her back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like the scene at the start with Donna and Martha. That's quite nice. But then Tennant's again going, ooh, I think I prefer it when you're fit. And it's like, shut up. It's not always about you, you prick.
This is so weird because we spend an awful lot of other episodes complaining there's not enough Doctor in certain elements.
I just, when he plays that kind of, you know, that
when he's 100% Cockney wide boy, it's not always appealing. Yeah, Donna's great, Wilf is great, Jacqueline King is better in this.
Well,
or I like her more in this than I like her.
She's the only fucking person in the cliffhanger and then the opening that is using her brain.
Yeah.
You're all just like banging around, oh, he's trapped in there, oh, I'm fanning around with the thing, and now I'm going to go and stand in the street for 10 minutes.
Yeah, that is a good line. You've got an axe!
And then she goes, burglars!
That is one of the weakest cliffhangers.
It is, isn't it?
Not even the cliffhanger, but like the final shot is the Doctor standing in a foggy street with a car alarm going off.
It's like, oh no! Will they be able to turn the car alarm off? I hope they've got their fog lights on.
Pollution and noise pollution. Will the Doctor be able to save the world next Saturday?
That cliffhanger is everything that, you know, Stephen Moffat has that thing about cliffhangers that, you know, it should move the story on.
Yeah.
That's just everything that you shouldn't do. It's just like standing around going, oh, what are we going to do? And somebody comes in with an axe and go, well, why don't you just...
Yeah.
First
pick. But no, okay. So, like, and there are other good things about. I don't want to be as harsh on Ryan Sampson as Luke Rattigan as you are, because I think he's actually quite good. I think he's deliberately pitching it so he's to be an annoying little shit.
Yeah, fine.
Probably, because at the end, yes. I think he's very good in those final moments where he switches places with the Doctor.
Yeah, but then I have a problem with that. Because
of course you do, Mark. It's the Sontaran stratagem in the Poison Sky.
No, the thing is, right, and we've talked about this loads and loads.
What a wee grump you are today!
I'll be better when we talk about the Amazing.
It's because you finished your pint of ocean like 10 minutes ago and you're gasping on another, is that right?
Well, no, because then I go, Irish shite, let's move on, and then I go down the stairs and get a pint. I want to keep going.
Favourite scene? None. Let's go. All right.
You are right. He is quite good when he sort of realises, oh no, they're going to betray me all along, like every other alien has to every other so-called Earth genius that wants to take over the world. And when he comes down and the Doctor does that thing, goes, oh, do something clever. And it's the same thing we've talked about again and again in the Russell T Davies era, that basically the Doctor doesn't really want to do his own dirty work.
Right.
And he'll just trick somebody into doing it for him. And he goes, oh, well, you know, I'm going to have to go up to this spaceship and blow it up. And unfortunately, I'm going to have to be there when it happens because I've got to press the button. So, sorry, bye, guys. Oh, I know you're all really, really sad about this, but I'm going to have to do it. No, don't try and stop me. I'm going to have to try and blow up the spaceship. You, evil genius kid, yeah? Do something clever, eh?
Yeah.
Then he goes up to the spaceship, and then he's talking for ages, going, fucking, if he's not going to come up here and take my place, I really misjudged this, because I'm going to have to blow up the ship, I'm going to die, I'll talk a bit more. And he's fucking playing for time until this kid goes, do you know what, I'll kill myself to save the planet.
Yeah. Yeah, it is quite passive-aggressive, isn't it?
It's really, like, it's quite an... I think it casts him in quite an unpleasant light. And it wouldn't necessarily matter so much if he just went, do something clever, he goes up, has a brief sort of thing, and then swapped over. But it goes on for so long that the only way to watch that is going, he's just playing for time because he doesn't think that Luke Rattigan's going to do it immediately, and maybe he should just hold out a bit longer and maybe he'll do it. It seems like at no point has he ever really planned to blow up that spaceship himself.
Well, I'm just going to leave it there. I'm not going to agree or disagree.
Okay. No, that's fine. I mean,
which
I'm
admittedly
right.
Is pretty
right,
shit
though.
For listeners.
I am right. I'm right.
No, okay, fine.
I'm right, though. I'm right.
All right, what's your favourite performance then?
You know, I know.
I'll tell you what. What's your favourite performance? It's not Bernard Cribbins. There we are. Because I know you're going to see it.
No, I wasn't going to see Bernard Cribbins actually. And look, I'll point out the notepad. It says Christopher Ryan.
Christopher Ryan.
I do think he is very good, and I know what you're saying, and I do get that.
Yeah.
The way it's written, but he plays the way it's written very, very well.
Yeah, he is good.
So yeah, so Christopher Ryan.
Yeah. Who would have thought that the guy who played Mike and the Young Ones had such effective range?
Yeah, he's great. Did you see Jeeves and Wooster with Robert Webb and...
The play? No.
Yeah,
no.
He was great in that.
Who was he playing?
Everybody that wasn't Jeeves and Wooster.
Oh, right, okay.
He was fantastic.
Oh, okay, that makes it. My favourite performance, I think, is... it's a choice between one of the regulars. I think Catherine Tate.
She's good.
Very nice human performance in amongst... Yep. It's a performance you care about in amongst an awful lot of them that you don't.
Yeah.
And my favourite scene is, I don't know, Donna trapped in the TARDIS.
Yeah, that's good.
Working out what to do.
That's good. I like that one. And then when she's kind of working her way through the Suntan strip. Yeah. Strip? Ship. It's like Las Vegas.
Yeah, it's just the Suntan strip.
Loads of really garish neon signs promoting clone feeders. I like that. That scene very much, but I really like the scene at the end between her and Wolf. That's really nice and sweet.
Yeah,
that's good.
I mean, okay, I do also like the end, not that one, but I love the ending, the very ending. I love going back to the old school 60s
and
70s.
That's a nice touch.
The 60s cliffhangers where, whoa, oh no, the next adventure, brilliant, what's going to happen?
Yeah, the next adventure's starting now, not next week, oh god. Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, I do like that.
It is a bit like, you know, Star Trek gripping the things and sort of like falling over, but it's exciting.
Yeah, there's a bit of that, isn't there? Yeah, there's a bit of that. Door slamming, jiggle. Now everyone, if you could just, on the count of three, jiggle. Yeah. okay, right, I think we've picked that carcass clean.
Yeah.
This on Darren's Stratagem, The Poison Sky. We're going to take a wee break, get ourselves another bevy, and we're going to come back with The Invasion. Okay, we're back. It's The Invasion. That's what we've paired Suntaran Stratagem Poison Sky with. Why? Unit. That's why.
Unit, indeed. Well, we've done a load of Suntaran stories already, so we thought it'd be a bit pointless to kind of compare and contrast in detail. So we thought we'd compare and contrast portrayal of Unit.
Yeah. So, I mean, this was billed, or Suntaran Stratagem was billed as being the big Unit comeback.
Yep.
I know they'd been in Aliens of London, World War III, but this is the first time that they feature.
Yeah.
Shame, then. So it's the Unit, which is the first... it's the Invasion, which is the first Unit one. Stats, 8-part adventure by Derek Sherwin and directed by Douglas Camfield. It was broadcast between Saturday 2nd of November 1968 and Saturday the 21st of December 1968. All of them going out 5.15 to 5.40 with an average rating of about... 6.97 million. Okay. The lowest was Saturday 23rd of November 1968, which was 6.4 million, and the highest was episode 1, which was 7.3 million. This is a story of a many firsts. Mm-hmm. The changing of an era, you can see it happening right
here.
Though 50 years poll, where do you think it is?
It's probably quite high. It's quite a well-loved story. I know certainly Richie, it's one of his favourite Doctor Who stories of all time.
Yeah, he was supposed to be a guest.
He was sadly not able to make it today. So we're talking about it without him.
Yeah.
He's, you know, he'll just have to shout at the radio. The radio. He'll just have to shout at the wireless or however it is you listen to these podcast thingies.
I like that you think that we, in your head, we have some kind of like public funded backing on a national platform.
This is going out on the wireless,
right? Yeah. Well, I mean, once we're done here, Dame Jenny Murray's coming in to do Women's Hour afterwards at the studio.
And that's all up coming up on your BBC Radio 4. Imagine the BBC fucking gave an hour and a half over to me and you to talk about Doctor Who.
Ah, that'd be amazing.
Be ridiculous.
It'd be amazing.
I mean, I'm sure the fan show's only about 20 minutes, if that.
If that. It's like 8 minutes long, isn't it? But yeah, Invasion, where is it?
Top. I would say probably top 40.
Top 40?
What about number 27.
Oh, you were really near. You were really near. 33. Oh,
okay.
33 is the invasion, and it's between Horror of Fang Rock. Mm-hmm.
Good story.
Evil of the Daleks.
Also a good story.
Yeah. How do we want to start this? Okay. I think the memory cheats with this one as well.
Okay.
It's popularly thought to be a very good story, and I'm not about to argue that it is not.
Good
start. But the stuff that people remember, the mm-hmm. stuff that people like, the stuff that people take away from, like, okay, for you, is it Jeff Waddle, Jeff Waddell, apologies if we ever pronounced the mm-hmm. name incorrectly, said on Facebook when we were asking for, is it Facebook or Twitter, said that it was 8 episodes of joy. I'll wager, Jeff, you haven't seen The Invasion in quite a while, I think it's 8 episodes of joy, because it's not, I don't want to go down that road of it's too long,
mm-hmm.
but there are some startlingly unsatisfactory, very boring episodes in The Invasion, which come very early on in the run. You know, when we think about the Cybermen,
mm-hmm.
Cybermen feature very, very little. In
yes,
this.
They do.
Very little, and they don't show up until the end. But what we have in the lead-up to these iconic moments, these iconic shots, the Cybermen looking great, are like whole episodes where nothing happens. There's just a lot of escaping from stuff and being mm-hmm. thrown into coffins and all that kind of stuff. A lot of Tobias Vaughn opening and closing walls very slowly and talking to a very indistinct...
Look, it works for the Sarah Jane Adventures.
Well, yeah. But, you know, there's just a lot of... at the expense of having the Cybermen from the start, what we have is a very indistinct kind of,
I don't know if that's true.
Like you would see it inside a fucking rabbit's cage or something.
Thing.
The cyber
right.
controller.
Fair enough.
What's very interesting about Doctor Who at the moment, the Series 9 that we have, mm-hmm. is that everything is a to be continued. So that we do not get presented with a full story in that 50-minute section. Mm-hmm. We have to wait. And we have to wait to see what we feel about a story. I know that we've had two-parters and continued, but this is the first time that we've kind of experienced Doctor Who in the way that people experienced it in the 40s, 40s and 50s. in the 60s.
On the radio,
and the 70s.
On the wireless.
You know, we think of The Invasion as a great story. What must it have been like for people watching it back then when the meat and the drink, the stuff that you really like about the story, didn't show up for 6 weeks? You have episodes, you know, let's say episode 2, I think. Maybe episode 3. Nothing really happens in episode 3. And the most interesting thing that happens there is that at the end of it, Jamie gets into a coffin and something moves.
There's the lift shaft.
That's exciting.
It's like Die Hard again.
Yeah, okay. But there's excitement, and then there's nothing happening.
But that's
just really nice. That's really exciting. Nothing happening is what it is. When we see that ratings fall or rise,
uh-huh.
having no idea that you were going to have a story that gives us such iconic moments,
mm-hmm.
but in the midst of watching it, do people just go, "This is shit"?
But I don't think it's boring.
I'm not saying it's shit either, and I'm not saying that it's boring. But I just feel that there's an awful lot of stuff in here which, done even a millimetre to the left or to the right of how it is done, The Invasion may have been considered one of the worst Doctor Who's ever made.
Nah, I don't think so. I think there's enough in there for that not to be the case. But I think maybe we're having a problem here is that we know from the DVD cover that the Cybermen are in it. Now, was that the case back in the 60s when they're watching it? Or are they just watching this kind of mysterious story about
the fact that it's called
a big corporation?
Yeah.
You know, but they're in some sort of pact with an alien race, but we don't know who that alien race is until the end of part 4.
Yeah.
So then when you watch it now, you can watch it week on week if you want, but you're still going to be expecting the Cybermen to turn up, and that's still going to colour your view of everything up until that point when they turn up.
Yeah.
There's no way for you to actually get into the head of somebody.
I suppose that's the key issue. Did people know the Cybermen were going to show up or not? Because if they didn't, the first maybe four episodes, and Patrick Troughton, Fraser Hines, and Wendy Padbury are incredibly watchable actors. It's That is great. Kevin Stoney is a very effective baddie.
Absolutely,
there's no
yeah.
monsters, is a very effective baddie. There's also a lot to be said about the fact that it's always a thrill to see, as I kind of was talking about at the start of this episode, it's always a thrill to see somewhere that you can relate to, i.e. modern yeah. London. Unfortunately, it's in the missing episodes. There's a lot of great outdoor stuff going on.
Yeah.
You know, like episode one takes place basically all in the countryside with motorbike riders and
and that's really atmospheric.
Probably it's atmospheric.
Well, yeah,
know. You know, episode four it's fucking they are like James Bond esque shit where people are rescued from factories by helicopters and they're hanging off rope ladders and all that kind of
stuff. And then the Cybermen turn up at the end. And it's all really exciting.
Yeah, but ultimately nothing's happening. So how did people really react?
But then that's Doctor Who in a serial format. It's this, like it's giving you just enough to keep the story ticking over, and then you know, we'll see you next week.
Yeah, but this is I'm not arguing that this is the only example of this. When we were recording the last episode, and Richie was here, and we said what we were going to do. His eyes nearly exploded out of his head.
Yeah.
When we said we're going to do the invasion, he wanted to be here. He wanted to do this. Every time I've spoken to somebody, my friend Sean, we're going to do the invasion. Oh, the invasion's brilliant! And it's like, well, there are great, great moments. Mm-hmm. There are certainly brilliant moments.
Yeah.
There are also stuff where it's quite a bit of a bore, I think.
But then,
and look at episode 7, which is all about trying to like shoot down the ship in the sky, and largely every bit of actual excitement happens at the other end of a
footage
or at the other end of a radio, which I suppose is very good in terms of like militaristic realism. How would a battle be if you were actually in it? Well, it would be no bigger than excitement in the space that you're in. It's just eked out far too long.
It's maybe one or two episodes too long. I'll certainly agree with you there.
Yeah, okay, but that's cliched. We all know,
but
that's a cliched
thing to say, but I think would have tightened a few things up, and I think you wouldn't have had as much an issue with it if it was a six-parter.
No, maybe not, but the angle that I want to go with is the memory cheats. You're talking about your initial idea of the Sontaran stratagem and the poison sky, right? Now the invasion is considered a classic.
Was it then? Well, there was no such thing as fan posts, but I suppose we've got no real way to know.
No, but I mean, when people think about when they enjoyed it, when they watched it.
But we talk about this a lot in this podcast. We did it with Robots of Death, where, you know, you were saying, you know, but why is this such a highly regarded story? And I said, well, you know, there's enough tentpole moments.
Effectively, deftly done.
And it's the same here. Fine, there's maybe some bits where the story dips.
Yeah.
Fine, there's maybe like a little bit too long spent fanning around with like stock footage of missiles being fired and models being blown up and stuff like that.
Or
and
going back to a house.
Maybe it's really, really weird that in episode 8 the Doctor goes, oh, the radio signal is housed in that building there, you've got to blow it up, and then they jump cut to the Brigadier going, well, we blew that up.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
Maybe that's a bit odd. Okay.
Yes. Right.
Yeah?
The one moment you're really gearing up for excitement and for fuck, you've done it. You've done it and it didn't work. Brilliant.
There's little things like that which you forget because what you have are these great moments, the Doctor and Jamie under London in a canoe.
Yes.
You know, Cybermen breaking out of these things in London. Well, not the London Underground, but these sewers underneath London.
Yeah.
You know, Cybermen on the streets, which actually, for being this iconic moment, is very brief.
Seconds.
It's seconds of it.
Yeah.
But it really works. Even the bit where all the people are like looking up and like gripping their heads, it's like that thing in the Silurians.
Yeah.
You know, that great thing where it's just people you don't know being affected by what's going on, and it gives it this scale.
Yeah.
There's so much good little bits and pieces in there that I think, yes, you're right, it's memory.
Yeah.
And I think there's enough in there. Each of the 8 episodes has something in it that's quite exciting.
Mm-hmm.
That I think, people were enjoying.
Well, I would have to say that a lot of credit can go to Derek Sherwin as a writer. His dialogue is never functional. If you're being uncharitable, there are sometimes that Terry Nation scripts can be incredibly dialogue-wise bland.
Mm-hmm.
But Derek Sherwin has invested an awful lot in each of the characters that he's bringing to the screen.
Yeah.
Dr. Jamie and Zoe, all great, but like, you know, Isabel is a really appealing character. Yeah. The Brig is brilliant in this. It's nice to see Benton getting something to do.
Yeah.
And you know, like I don't know. It should be that should be one of the most boring things is the constant chats.
Yeah.
That I was going to call it Mavic Chen. Tobias Vaughan has. You really get him.
Yeah.
Really get him as a human.
He's a very, very multi-layered, very well written and very well performed villain.
Yeah.
He's great. One of my favourite scenes in the whole thing. You know, it doesn't have any of the lead actors in it, it doesn't have the Brigadier in it, it doesn't have Cybermen in it. It's Tobias Vaughan and Professor Watkins, and it's Vaughan handing him the gun.
Yes, that's a great one.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
So, like, that's what I'm saying. There is, in each and every one of these 8 episodes, there is one show-stopping moment.
Right.
And that's why I think that it is deservedly a classic. And I do get what you're saying, though. I do think that, you forget the fact that episode 8, there's very jarring cuts.
Yeah.
Where things are just, like, explained to you, oh, we blew up that thing. Like, the bit where they go, oh, well, the Cybermen have moved their ship further towards the Earth, so they're going to drop the bomb. They're still going to drop the bomb, but in a different way. Oh, well, we can redirect the Russian missile. It'll take them 12 minutes. Okay, well, we'll just wait here for 12 minutes.
Yeah.
And they sit, and then the clock goes around, and they go, well, we blew that up.
It's 12 minutes played out in real time.
But it's not, though. It's just kind of this kind of clock goes round.
Yeah.
There's a bit of tension, blows up, and then they're back in the field and they go back. There's a bit of fanning around with the TARDIS and they go back home. Yeah. You kind of forget all that because there's all this other great stuff that's going on.
Well, it's in the midst of a great battle with the Cybermen.
Yeah, which is great.
Which you've been waiting for ages. But, you know, like in your head, when you think of the invasion, you think that it happens all the time. When I started watching it again, I'm like, oh yeah, it's the end of episode 4 when the Cybermen thing happens. It's, no, it's not. It's the end of episode 7. But in my head,
with the battle,
And it's like, I know that probably too. It's probably because I was remembering the similar sort of battle in The Web of Fear with
which is episode 4
because that was another thought that I had is that there's a lot in this that is very familiar from The Web of Fear and whether people watching it at the time would have found it to have been a bit stale. There's a similar sort of pitched battle in a kind of industrial environment.
I don't know about stale. I wonder if it's
Douglas Canfield was the same director as well. And there's an awful lot of Cybermen in the sewers, which looks exactly as atmospherically shot, and it's lit and shot the same way as Yetis in the underground.
But I think what it is that they happened on The Web of Fear. They happened and they were like, oh my god, this is a great format. This is the format that we're going to save Doctor Who with.
Yeah.
We're going to ground him on Earth.
Yeah.
And he's going to fight alien threats with military backing.
Yeah.
And he's going to be like their scientific advisor and all that kind of thing. And so they lay the groundwork here based. And it's not the invasion. I think it is The Web of Fear that puts that idea in Derek Sherwin's head.
Yeah.
But I think, I don't know if it would have necessarily felt stale to viewers, but I think they would have gone, well, is this Doctor Who?
Mm-hmm.
This feels more like The Avengers. And I remember Richie and I had this conversation on Twitter, I think, where it's like, imagine watching the Pertwee era at the time. You've been watching Doctor Who since the 60s, and then he's swanning around in a car.
Yeah.
Then the TARDIS is gone, and he's just like pissing about in like a bright yellow car. You'd be like, what the fuck is this?
Yeah. I think of that.
This is not the Doctor Who I recognise.
I know exactly what the history of the show is, and I think that every time I see the Ambassador. Is this? What is this?
Yeah. And I think maybe that's. I wonder if that's how people were reacting to it.
Yeah.
You know. But we didn't have Twitter and Facebook in those days, so we'll never know. Or internet message boards.
Yeah.
So we'll never know 100%. But I do wonder if people were watching The Invasion and going, well, I'm enjoying this. This is exciting.
Yeah.
But is this Doctor Who?
Because wasn't it like once a year they would do like a modern London story? Like you had the Faceless ones and then you had The Web of Fear and this was that.
I guess so, yeah. I guess I never thought about it like that. But yeah, I suppose.
After the war machines. I don't know. I don't mean to suggest I don't like this story, because I do. Having watched this a good many times over over many years, I always watch it afresh, and I'm always taken back by it.
Yeah, me too.
You always see it in different. Go, I can't remember the pathway of this at all.
But I think that's the mark of a really good Doctor Who story. Is it's not the one that you go like something. I mean, as much as I love Spearhead from Space, I can recite most of that back to front.
Yeah,
and I think I watch now. I don't really pick up anything new from it. Mm. Whereas The Invasion. Part 3 in particular, for some reason, I was watching it and it just felt brand new.
Yeah.
Like I'd never watched it before. And I think that's really great. Like I always say Jurassic Park's a great movie because as many times as I've watched it, there's always just something else in there that I can pick up again as fresh.
Yeah. You always forget they have a sit-down dinner meal near the start of that, don't you?
Yeah. And I completely forget the slideshow and there's like... I think that's the mark of a good story. You know, like you say, the memory cheats. and you forget the good stuff, mm-hmm. but then and you forget the bad stuff. As,
you know, no, you forget the bad, you remember the good stuff.
Yeah.
Because it's the
but
most
But you also
iconic.
Forget, like, the little subtle touches as well. Like, I've completely forgotten. There's, there's just all these lovely little things. And, you know, God love them, Cosgrove Hall, who do the animations on Pirates 1 and 4. They are very good. But they can't quite capture, and you nobody can quite capture, apart from Patrick Troughton, that sort of expressive face. And the scene where they go into Isabel Watkins's house and she's like taking photos of herself, which sadly, you know, it doesn't exist because it's a thing. And she sort of, like, the doctor tries to help her with the camera and goes, taking photos of yourself, eh? Just this like really dismissive fashion. I would have just, I really want to see how he plays that properly.
Yeah.
Because it is really funny, especially in this, you know, modern age of, you know, of selfies and narcissism.
Well, my favourite bit is in episode 8 where the doctor's on the ground after the Cybermen battle and he starts very quickly getting into having his photograph taken by Isabel. And you think, imagine if episode 8 was missing.
Yeah.
And they did an animation of that. There's no way
that would
have been as good as it was.
No, of course it wouldn't. That's the thing, I mean, as great as these reconstructions are, they can't quite capture these little subtle touches.
No.
And again, these little subtle moments sometimes get lost.
Yeah.
You know, and then you go back and watch it again, you go, oh, fucking hell. You know, there was a bit I didn't remember last time because I was too busy being distracted by Cybermen at St. Paul's or...
Well, loads of stuff. I completely forgot about the rogue mad Cyberman.
Yes, that kind of wanders the sewers.
Yeah, and the noise that it makes.
It's
the
horrible.
Screaming noise. I completely forgot all about that.
There's so much in it that I think is really still relevant today. You know, just that idea of, like, this massive faceless corporation that's, you know, in all of our lives and all that kind of thing, that it's hiding a terrible threat. That's great.
Well, mass producing
radios that
consumer objects that will bring the world to a standstill.
Indeed. Everything about the invasion is fumbled in Rise of the Cybermen and the Age of Steel. I think it's a much better piece of satire about, like, the technology in our lives than it is. Because, you know, that was what they were trying to do with sort of the revived, this new Cyberman.
Yeah.
So, oh, well, you know, it's like, well, we love sort of iPods and stuff like that, right? So what if we do that? And it's like, oh, but augmentation. And it's like, but actually, all you need is Tobias Vaughn giving Jamie a radio and go, oh, this is one of the products that we make. And then it turning out that that's sending a signal around that will null everybody to the threat of the Cybermen and they'll come down and invade the planet.
You know, this is the card. You know what dates Rise of the Cybermen and the Age of Steel is that it's it focuses on technology that has largely been superseded now.
Yes.
You know, where it's Wi-Fi instead of, well, it's Bluetooth instead of Wi-Fi.
Yeah.
It's like headsets when people don't really use headsets anymore. It's kind of like, imagine if there was a Betamax monster. And then, like, the first time you see it again is on home video. It's like...
Yeah, you're like, well, this is...
this hasn't worked, has it? This is really dated, this thing.
But then, you know, you've got...
Betamax is the most dangerous thing on the planet right now. We've got to stop it, Rose. Yeah, all right.
And you did, because nobody uses it anymore. Mm-hmm. So I might as well not watch this episode.
Okay, let's move on from kind of like picking apart the architecture of the thing. The Briggs back. That's great. And he's back, because this is his second appearance. Outside of the fact that we are familiar with him, he is a great presence.
Yeah. And do you know what's great about having the Brig? Is that it just cuts out all of that kind of padding in Doctor Who stories where the Doctor has to kind of prove that he's the one that's going to help them and he's not actually trying to blow up the planet. He's not a traitor, he's not a spy.
That's good because there is none of that we've talked about before, but there's none of that. You're a spy! Acting.
There's none of it. You know, Tobias Vaughn is a bad guy.
Watching the War Games at the moment.
Oh, right, okay.
Because the Fact of Fiction and Doctor Who magazine is doing the War Games at the moment. So I'm kind of watching. There's an awful lot of, you are a spy! We will imprison you! You are a spy!
Well, they've got to make those 10 episodes up somehow.
Yeah, well, but you're right, with the Brigadier.
It just cuts all of that nonsense out.
Yeah.
you know, like, what I love about any unit story is that, you know, there will sometimes invariably be a bit where the Doctor swans into whatever research facility he has to go into that week, and they go, why should we listen to you? And the Brigadier goes, look, just listen to him, it's all fine. And then they just get on with the story. And I think that's great.
Let's go, we'll call it the Stalman reaction.
Yes. So that's great, and you have that bit in part two where they're being followed, and you're like, oh they're in trouble. But no, they're not. They're just being picked up to be taken to the unit so that they can help out.
Yeah.
And it just saves so much time and so much boring functionality of kind of just getting the Doctor to it. It's just like, nope, he's working for unit. Tobias Fawn's a bad guy, he's working for somebody else.
Yeah.
This is where our players are, and then we can go on with the story.
I guess familiarity with unit also hangs over this story and ruins it slightly. When we talked about the Web of Fear, we talked about how it was obviously set up that the Brigadier was a legitimate suspect.
Yes.
And we do not experience that watching it now, because we know A, he's not familiar with the story, but B, totally he's not, because he's one of the best not Doctor characters in the whole of the history of the show. So when you watch it, the attempt to make him seem like he's a suspect, he did it, he's responsible, you go, I'm a bias. But what is essentially a very atmospherically shot, the kind of the car following the Doctor and Jamie.
Yeah.
The fact that you see John living there,
that's true.
You go, just hurry up. We know you're coming to get them, and that's fine. And just hurry up with that, because you do. Again, it's interesting looking at this story or trying to see how it would be observed at the time.
Yeah.
You know, there is a point in that story, that scene, where it's set up to be a real bit of intrigue.
Yeah.
And thrills and chills, and it means nothing to us now.
Yeah. Because we know.
Because within it, there's such a loving, familiar element to the makeup of that scene.
John Levine.
And shot deliberately side on, so that, like, it's almost like they're. I mean, I know Douglas Camfield and John Levine worked together, and Douglas Camfield very much liked him, but it's like, when you first see him framed in the shot in the car in profile, there's no way that he's not being singled out to be a main character for the rest of the season.
Yes, true.
Next decade, you know.
True.
This is why I like this. It is one of the most talk aboutable Doctor Who stories.
Well, because it's such an important story.
Yeah.
I mean, it lays the, you know, not just unit and that kind of setup. Obviously, it's not quite the unit that we'll come to know and love.
Yeah. Well, going back to the point from Sontaran's strategy, is that there's loads of people employed by this unit.
Yeah, true.
Whereas when we hit Terror of the Autons, there's three people on payroll.
Yes. But they're all likeable, you know. Jimmy, he's good.
Jimmy.
But yeah, but they've got like helicopters at their disposal. They've got, you know, they're like a big.
Yeah, it's a proper organization.
But I think even down to the fact that, you know, it has the Doctor team up with the villain to beat the aliens at the end. It's like, that's the Pertwee era in a nutshell. It's like, the Master teams up with some aliens, then realises that they're probably going to kill him. Yeah. So he'll team up with the Doctor, and then they'll both defeat the aliens.
Yeah. Kevin Stoney does the turn from supporting the alien menace to turning against it. Far more effective than Roger Delgado does.
It feels more natural than kind of just like, oh, I never really thought of that. It's like, well, actually, no.
Yeah.
I've had enough of this. Like, I can't believe that they're doing this to me, and, you know, like, I feel properly betrayed. It's like, it's a kind of better performance than Ryan Sampson gives, but a similar motivation, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, Ryan Sampson's performance is very much, okay.
Yeah, they're not to be trusted, though. Okay.
Yeah. Or Roger Delgado at the end of Terror of the Autons.
He goes, oh, yeah.
They'll just come back and start to harm you. Oh, fuck, you're right, huh?
Imagine. Oh, that'd be great.
What's even better is there would be a pickup from the cliffhanger that's starting the next episode. Just open on. Oh no! Oh no! Yes, that's right, the Master. Oh shit! uh, Okay. All right. One of the things I wanted to talk about is I was going to do this as a separate little feature on the website.
Oh, yes, of course, yeah.
So I decided to go on a bit of a locations trip, and tying in with the invasion, I started there, and I visited. So it was Travers's house, but obviously now Isabel and
The Watkinses.
The Watkinses, yeah. The not Travers's, and decided to walk from there to the IE buildings.
Oh, nice.
What is Milbank Tower on the Thames. What I love about doing stuff like that is that where the houses are, where the locations are, there's nothing to suggest that in the fiction that's not also where they are. And making the travel between the two places, you do find it funny what may happen within the scenes that you don't see. So St. James Gardens in Shepherd's Bush is where the Travers' house is.
Yeah.
So I started there. What's also very interesting is I'm standing around on a perfectly suburban street taking photographs of people's houses with long hair and a big long black coat.
It's that man again!
only realising when I'm taking the photographs and I'm looking back at the photos that I've taken, looking that you can see children's toys in the windows of this house. I go, oh fuck. And people like going by in cars, giving you an odd look and stuff like that.
It's for a Doctor Who podcast. I'm sorry. But don't arrest me.
Yeah, but then exaggerating all your movements, so as if you're trying to not attract attention, but go, oh well, I mean, he's obviously not looking shady. He's obviously looks like he's doing something perfectly legitimate. But I walked from there. So it's a really nice house. So I saw that little the house there.
I'm sure the current owners are very pleased to hear that.
But I walked from there to Milbank Tower. Mm-hmm. Right, it took me 3 hours.
Oof, that's a long.
So if in the fiction it's Shepherd's Bush, which is where the Travers' house is, and Milbank Tower is on the Thames, where it is beside Vauxhall, it means that the Doctor and Jamie and Isabel and Zoe, in the various trips back and forward that they go from the Travers' house to the IE building, at a push, it takes them, like, you know, the quickest they could be is an hour and a half if they're just walking. Either that, or between scenes, what we don't see is like the Doctor and Jamie or Isabel and Zoe getting on the tube or getting on the bus or getting a taxi or something like that. But I just find it funny. It took me 3 hours, and it takes you through, so along Bayswater Road, down through Hyde, the majority of Hyde Park,
past
the Serpentine, past the Royal Albert Hall, you know, essentially down Buckingham Palace Road as well.
Oh, right, of course it would do, wouldn't it? If you were in Melbourne,
right over Vauxhall, Vauxhall Bridge, past the MI6 building, all that kind of stuff. It took me 3 hours, and I was just kind of dawdling. Right, an hour and a half according to Google Maps it takes. So we're you know, 8 episodes has been distilled down from what could have been far far longer. It could have been so much longer if they decided to show any of these extended trips that they took. I mean, also, how long has it taken the Doctor to go from London out to an airfield outside London and then back in and then back out again and back in? It's like 3 or 4 times.
London traffic wasn't as bad as it is now in 1978 or 1976.
Even if it was London City Airport, he's still there about 45
still
minutes in an army jeep.
Ways away,
I enjoyed walking in the footsteps of the people going between those two things and seeing what they would have seen. Oh my goodness, they went through Hyde Park. I mean, the Diana Memorial Fountain would not have been there at the time.
There probably wasn't as many Nando's in 1968.
As
you would have walked past.
Yeah. I wonder if on the way there to save the Doctor's life, Isabel and Zoe stopped at a Pret for some coffee and a brownie. But did they, you know, did they look at the Albert Memorial when they were going past there? Stopped to take pictures. Walking about all the way in their feather boa that she had on. Did people stop her? You know, were they chatted up as they took their walk through their walk through town? Like that. It was really nice going to Milbank Tower.
Mm-hmm.
Because there is a little cafe right. There's a Pizza Express, but there's a little cafe right inside the complex, which anyone can use. So it was nice to just sit and have a little coffee within a Doctor Who location and be able to really take it in, really sample the thing rather than show up.
Yeah.
Take a, you know, perfunctory 5 minutes.
Go off,
take a photograph. I did have to explain to a man, like a security guard ran over and told me to stop taking pictures. But I don't know what's in it now, but it was the headquarters of the Labour Party before.
Oh, right.
When Tony Blair was leader and then Prime Minister. But he rushed over and I had to, like, and it was like, it was, I don't know, it was like an Asian guy or something. And he had no idea, like, what Doctor Who was.
Sorry, I just love the idea that rather than just go, oh no, sorry, I'll stop taking photos. You went, well, actually, it's, are you aware of a television programme called Doctor Who?
I didn't engage him, he wanted to know what I was doing, and me just going, oh sorry, I'll move on, obviously didn't cut it. So I had to explain to him, go, look, I'm a Doctor Who fan. and I was like, you know, Doctor Who is on just now. No, what are you doing? And I was like, going, right, well, in 1968, this was used as a filming location. He had no idea what it was because this was obviously not part of his cultural background.
But or his employee training.
Well, yeah, but the fact that I seemed to just be bamboozled, he probably thought I was a fucking mental case that had escaped and something like that. So he was just like, all right, on your way. Just let me go.
Bounce.
But like, it was so
that's
comical.
Brilliant.
It was a good laugh. but that's the thing. Like I felt I had to explain Doctor Who I had to have the Doctor Who story ready. You know, and saying that I was doing this on behalf of On the Time Lash, like I was like an official correspondent for BBC Radio 4. If you not listen to On the Time Lash, it's on before Women's Hour with Dame Jerry Murray. But you know, like I felt I had to have the explanation ready because you know after the St James Gardens at the start of the day where people are looking at me taking photos of houses, I feel like I have to be as forthcoming and honest.
So I
swear I'm not some sort of covert paedophile that's wandering around. Alright, let's bring it in. Favourite scene, favourite performances?
Favourite scenes, yeah. Like I've already said, I think I love that scene between Professor Watkins and Tobias Vaughn.
Yeah.
This kind of shrewish, meek scientist against this kind of powerful businessman.
Yeah.
I think it's great. And, you know, the part 4 cliffhanger, the part 6 cliffhanger, they're the big, iconic show-stopping moments.
Yeah.
They're very good.
Yeah. They're the most iconic scenes in Doctor Who, do you think?
Yeah, I think that's a fair... Certainly some of them, you know.
Outside of imagery like the Doctors, the TARDIS...
I mean, I think basically you've got...
What, Daleks.
Daleks on Westminster Bridge.
Yeah.
Cybermen at St. Paul's. Those are the two big ones, aren't they? Really?
Yeah. My favourite scene is... I love the battle at the end with the Cybermen.
Mm.
Love the battle at the end. I also love all this stuff in the kind of the middle section with the rogue Cybermen.
Sewers,
in the factory being experimented on in the first place. I love all that kind of stuff. Favourite performance? It's not really a bad performance in the thing, really, is there?
No. Kevin Stone is great. Yeah.
I mean, Peter Halliday is a good performer. I don't necessarily know if he makes Packer seem like a legitimate threat.
You can kind of tell he's got like a bit of a vicious streak to him. As the story goes on and more and more things fall apart, he does kind of become this kind of bumbling, terrified little man.
I mean, what it seems like is that he's a man of authority, but who's never been challenged.
Yes.
And once he is, he has literally nothing to fall back on.
Yeah.
Like, the veneer is just it's completely revealed how ineffectual he is. But he's not a bad actor. He's excellent. He's very funny.
Yes.
He's brilliant.
Yeah, I like Dominic Allen as the policeman. You know, the policeman that tries to stop him going down the manhole.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, oh, you kids! Well, I'm going to come down and get them. He's great.
And then dies. Horribly.
Killed.
That's such
killed
a shame.
Horribly.
Yeah, he's a laugh.
He's good.
He's a laugh. It's a shame that two episodes of this are missing.
It's a great shame.
Maybe that's where not a lot of the boredom. Because I wasn't monumentally bored with this. But when my interest waned, maybe it's because exciting episodes are missing and they're reduced to not very representative animations.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, they are good animations.
Better than nothing.
It is good. I mean, what you get is good.
Yeah.
But it's just, you know, with all these things, it's just a shame that the originals don't exist.
Yeah.
Or do they? What I also like about the invasion is the Brigadier saying crazy kids.
Yes.
Love that.
Yeah, he does seem like a jovial dad at a Christmas party, doesn't he?
He really does. It's great.
He is a much more light and...
Yes.
He's a lighter character than he would become.
Yeah.
in later Pertwee stories. You know the way that he keeps saying Jimmy and like a sitting partially on tables?
Yeah.
It seems like he's running a youth set.
Yeah. He's going to just... Could just refer everybody by their first names, yeah?
All right, hey, Jimmy. So, hey, Jimmy. Well, come on, man. What seems to be the problem? He's like fucking Jeff running Biker Grove.
He's like...
in the back of a plane.
Yeah. The Brigadier and the Invasion is a lot like a community center.
Support worker guy.
Support worker. Or that geography teacher you had that would turn up in jeans and trainers.
Yeah.
Hey, guys.
Yeah. Come on, man. Why didn't you do your homework? Come on.
Come on, you know? What's the problem, yeah?
Hey, you shot that missile. No one else. Yeah. You. And only you could have done it, man, because you believed in yourself.
Because the best...
Well done, Jimmy.
The best highlight, to sort of highlight that point, is in the end, sort of towards the end of episode 7, where they're all... Once they've launched the missile, and they've blown up the ships, and they're all like, whoa! And he's having like a lot of fun, and then he hears where he goes, no, quiet, everybody, quiet. Okay, we've had our fun, but there are some serious things to do now. So let me just take this radio call.
That's a great. You know the spin-off Lethbridge Stewart books that they've got coming out now.
Yeah, I've not read any of them.
Let's try and pitch one where he has a community super, like he runs the Grove.
He runs Biker.
Oh, no, the pickle gone middle. I apologise to any residents of Newcastle and Sunderland and Middlesbrough who might be listening.
We've had fun.
Terrible accent. All right, well, that's it, really, isn't it? That's anything it. You want to say?
I just remembered one thing I forgot to say about the Santana stratagem.
Mm-hmm.
Donna, near the end, where Donna rests, she gets taken off the ship, and they get the TARDIS back, and Steyr comes in. What's happening? And then there's this Santaran that's just like, oh, there was a woman on the ship, and so the TARDIS is gone. It's like, why have they not dubbed over either like Dan Starkey or Chris Ryan's voice?
Yeah.
That's clearly just the actor who's wearing the costume
inside the helmet,
saying the lines for the benefit of Chris Ryan to react to, and then they've kind of just forgotten to put on any sort of audio dubbing. It's really odd. I've never noticed it before.
There's something jarring about that.
You're like, whoa,
yeah, I know what you mean.
That's just a guy wearing a helmet. It's really weird. Anyway, I'm not gonna dwell. You know, we're not here to...
No, you've said your piece.
Hey, guys.
Yeah, you said...
Hey, guys, you know. I'm rolling my sleeves up, got my jeans on. It's all right, let's live and let live, yeah? It's okay.
All right, Brigadier, I will. Okay, well, that's the end. Thank you for joining us, as always, faithful listeners. Hopefully that hasn't shitted up a few front doorsteps with... I've no idea what that means.
Ruffled a few feathers, I think, is the word you were meaning for. Shitted a few doorsteps is also good.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, the other day, right, I was walking up to Old Croft, up Lothian Road.
Shattered doorstep.
No, I walked past a shitted bus stop. And I mean a shitted bus stop. So like, the bench was just covered in human shit.
Okay.
It was horrific.
How did you
It was
think,
the most horrific
how
thing.
How did you determine it to be human?
You can tell. A dog's not going to get up on the bench and take a shit.
This is why we're not on Radio 4. This is why we're not.
Anyway.
Well,
shitted bus stops aside.
Shitted bus stops. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you. If you want to communicate with us, Facebook, Twitter, or email on thetimelash@outlook.com. Mm-hmm. We'll be back in 2 weeks. Well, mm-hmm. We'll be back in a week with our normal On the Time Lash extra. Mm-hmm. And then we're back in 2 weeks with the regular podcast, which, it's The Doctor's Daughter, and what are we pairing up with The Doctor's Daughter?
Because we had two, and I don't think we ever decided which one we were going to do. We were thinking Galaxy 4. It's Hartnell. It's going to be a Hartnell.
Yeah.
We're thinking Galaxy 4, because, you know. Oh, attractive human beings versus ugly monsters. Yeah. Which are the bad guys? Yeah. Oh, not who you would expect. Or the Ark, because again, you know, the human race and alien servants kind of at odds with each other.
Yeah.
So yes,
in a kind of jungle-like enclosed spaceship space. I don't know. I think maybe Galaxy 4. Shall we do that?
We could do Galaxy 4. We could do a recon episodes.
Let's do that. So that's what we're going to have in 2 weeks' time. Thank you for joining us. Thank you very much. I know we say this, but I really want to get that across to you guys. Thank you very much. I've been Ben.
I've been Mark.
And next up on BBC Radio 4 is The Archers.